You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Friday, 18 June. I'm Chantal Marks, standing in for Simon Brown and coming to you live from the MoneyWeb studios in Houghton, Johannesburg. On the show today, we have Nick Kunze from Sanlam Private Wealth on markets, John Luce from FNB on commercial property considerations post-COVID-19, and Nick Dennis from Anchor Capital on the difference between good and fad tech investing. Some morning headlines. Locally, we have Mediclinic opts for own power too. I think we're going to get a lot more companies getting off the grid soon, especially following last week's stage four debacle. And internationally, Japan inflation gains for the first time since March 2020. That's also quite concerning, particularly given what the Fed said just a couple of days ago around its outlook for inflation. Morning markets, US markets mixed. The Dow was down 0.6%, the S&P flat, and the Nasdaq up 0.9%. Asia's green, Sydney up 0.4%, and Tokyo up 0.3%. And commodities steadied overnight with gold at $1,786 per ounce. The Rand at 14.07. US and European futures pointing to a better day today. 10 cents up in Hong Kong, but miners are down in Oz.
MoneyWeb Now on the money.
We are talking to Nick Kunze from Sanlam. Morning, Nick. Thank you so much for joining us today. There was a bit of chaos on markets yesterday following the Fed's surprisingly hawkish minutes. But one of the other drivers of volatility was the story about the Chinese state trying to cool down commodity markets. Is this even a thing, and has it happened in the past?
Morning, Chantal. Fun and games yesterday. I think you even throw something else in. You can throw the fact that it was futures closed out in South Africa. It doesn't have a massive effect, but there certainly was some game and sort of plays around that. And then, of course, today is triple witching in the States. That's when futures and options index and equity options expire. So a lot of fun and games coming. So I think a whole combination of all of that put into the pot and it led for an extremely volatile session. I think the Fed sort of set the tone on Wednesday. I think it caught a lot of people by surprise. It's slightly hawkish slant, as you said, and that sort of got the dollar bulls coming in, which knocked commodities. And in fact, that weak commodity slant from late Wednesday night, and then of course, as you said, the Chinese coming out, and they've been very vocal about speculation in the iron ore markets and the Dalian index, where most of these futures contract trade. They've been raising margin rates. But putting this sort of money where the mouth is, and actually saying we're going to actually tap into our strategic reserves of iron ore and commodities and stop the speculation. It took another smack. So just in summary, a bit of a long one, Chantal, but it's a bit of a perfect storm for commodities, really.
Yeah, I mean, because I was just thinking, commodities prices really are kind of hard-coded to reflect demand and supply dynamics, right? And perhaps the cost curve acting as some sort of a floor. So what you're saying is that they're actually looking at tapping into strategic reserves. So basically, they're going to manipulate the supply side.
Yeah, we love that, eh? I mean, just when you thought central banks had finished with their QE manipulation, along come the Chinese to play in the commodity space. But I mean, that's exactly right. Commodities, for me, have always been sort of simple stupid. You know, supply and demand, as you said. You know, we know there's sort of a supply deficit, for example, for copper for 2022. So we understand the price dynamics there. But no, Chinese coming. Look, I think it needs to be put in a bit of context, too. I mean, there is a lot of speculation in that Chinese commodity space. That Dalian Index commodity exchange, which was launched a couple of years ago, iron ore contract, one of the most traded contracts on it. I mean, there's a lot of people telling that the iron ore, and you would know this as well, I mean, it cannot be worth more than $100 a ton. There's so much iron ore flying around the world right now, but yet the price is at $200, and a lot of that is apparently this sort of speculation. So I don't think they're wrong coming in and quashing it a little bit, but they should be looking rather sort of increasing, sort of punishing the speculators, raise margin rates, not necessarily flood the market with physical commodities. But anyway, who knows what the Chinese are up to.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that it kind of defeats the whole, or it defeats the point. You don't necessarily want to intervene directly in markets if your real problem is that you've got a speculators are really throwing off the price.
100%.
And then I picked up on Imperial's acquisition in Namibian cold storage yesterday. So obviously part of their gateway to Africa strategy. And I just got to thinking, I mean, they're the first ones now to really go back in hard into Africa. Do you think that's something that the South African companies will do again after their initial disaster in Africa and then disasters in Europe and Australia and everywhere else? And do you really think that they should be doing anything outside of the borders of South Africa?
Yeah, I mean, every time I read about a company sort of going to either Oz or into Africa, you kind of want to short the share, because these South African companies think they can replicate what they've done so well here, and that sort of one size fits easily sort of north of our borders, and evidently not. I mean, the superstars of that were ShopRite. I mean, they really put a foot wrong, and for them to come out and exit Nigeria in the last few months ago, that really tells you that things are that tough to operate. I don't know, compared to a slightly different space, the logistics business is a slightly different space, I guess, to selling sort of food or clothing or the like. And look, these guys are pretty good at what they do. Look, I'm not anti-Africa. I'm a bit of a fan. I think, you know, you've got that youth demographic coming through quite strongly, where you've got the rest of the world aging. So I think at some point you've got to take a look. But yeah, I mean, history is littered with our local companies sort of trying it and not working. But I'll give them a benefit of the doubt. I think they certainly, if anyone could do it, I think they can.
That was Nick Kunze from Sanlam. Appreciate your early morning contribution.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
And then we have John Lewis from F&B on the line. He is a commercial property strategist at F&B Commercial Property Finance. Good morning, John.
Morning, Chantel.
So, I mean, it's a bit different, our conversation, to what we would normally have on the show, which would mainly focus on the REIT space. But I want to take a more philosophical slant with you, particularly relating to property and commercial property in particular post-COVID, and what is going to happen to CBDs. I'm thinking specifically about Sandton and Cape Town. What would be your best and worst case scenarios?
Well, look, I mean, the worst-case scenario for CBD is probably how Joburg CBD played out in the 80s and the 90s. There are some warning signs for the likes of Sandton, Sunning Hill, the big office nodes, and Cape Town CBD as well, because you've got high vacancy rates in office. You've got, I think, a lift in the work-from-home trend. In other words, it's been boosted by the successful lockdown work from home experiment, if you could call it that. So we are probably going to have less people on a daily basis being in the office. It doesn't say all of them are going to work from home, but less than pre-COVID. And of course, the popularity of high density sort of upmarket residential near to office nodes was avoiding the traffic and staying near to work. But if that's alleviated because you have to be at work less, so you don't have to commute into the city as much anymore, then I think the appeal of living in high density residential in the CBD is less for the higher end of the higher income, higher skilled part of the labor market. And already you've got high residential vacancy rates, according to TPN surveys, in Cape Town and Sandton CBDs. So you've got high office, high residential. What happens next? Well, I think values have to decline, and I think you probably have to go for a more affordable housing solution. Income demographic has to change. But it doesn't have to be a chaotic situation like the Joburg CBD of the 80s and the 90s. But I think we need to understand what we're dealing with here. There are warning signs when you've got high vacancies in both office and residential. Something will have to give.
And do you think this is something that the market will kind of do itself, or do you think that there needs to be some regulatory intervention, perhaps, or kind of like the invisible hand on the situation?
Tough one. I think the market can do it itself. I mean, I think the property industry has probably learnt a lot from the lessons of Joburg CBD and, you know, others, Durban CBD perhaps, and so on. So, you know, be more realistic and look for the right repurposing opportunities for property sort of quite proactively. And then, as I say, the, to me, the right way to repurpose now would probably be, amongst other things, would be more affordable housing. You know, as opposed to just abandoned buildings and hijackings, as you saw in the you know, sort of a chaotic situation in the CBD. So I do think that we've learned a lot of lessons, and you know, the market can probably sort out the change itself.
And where do you think the development opportunities lie? So, I mean, obviously, when you look at a CBD, you'll have to start thinking about different kinds of residential. Perhaps you need to start thinking about education and healthcare. But I know specifically right now, there's a lot of focus on warehousing because of this e-commerce story. Do you see that big opportunity in warehousing, or do you think it's a little bit overcooked and that South Africans love malls and will probably return at some point?
South Africans, look, I mean, I think you must take the lockdown situation as abnormal. And, you know, once the vaccine rollout is more widespread and, you know, you would assume that malls would normalize significantly. But over the longer term, I do believe not only are we on a move to a bigger work from home level, but in the retail space, a bigger online sort of part of the market too. So I think that, you know, a lot of what's going to happen in retail is going to be last mile depots for deliveries and, you know, various, you know, pickup points and whatever it might be. It's going to be a changed retail industry. I do think that that's coming. It's just a question of how fast. I mean, you look at the developed world, if you could call it that, the developed countries, the US and so on. I mean, yes, the retailers has come under pressure to a certain extent from online retail. It's a significantly bigger sort of part of retail than what it was a number of years ago. And I can't see why we won't follow suit. But one has to be realistic. It's not all going to happen tomorrow. I think that there is a certain amount of normalization after lockdown of malls.
And then what is your thinking around specific areas? So obviously we do have a very unique set of circumstances in the big cities. But there's also this trend of people kind of moving to smaller towns and coastal areas. Is that manifesting on the ground? Are you seeing movement there?
I'm not clear if we're seeing any additional movement in the so-called semigration from what we saw before lockdown. You know, in the US, you've seen reports of a sudden surge in moves to smaller cities and towns sort of during and after the lockdown period. South Africa doesn't seem to move that quickly. We've had a longer-term trend of semigration, which has benefited most notably the Western Cape, and probably I think the new one is the Southern Cape to a greater extent, and the north coast of Durban or KZN. So but that's been a trend that's been building for, you know, probably the past decade or two. I don't see, and I think it continues. I sense that it's still continuing. But any additional surge in this from lockdown, I'm not clear on that yet.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, John. And that was John Luce, Property Sector Strategist from F&B Commercial Property Finance.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
As investment professionals, we often get asked about all kinds of schemes promising to be game changers and 100 baggers. And I have my own thoughts on what constitutes a good and safe investment. But even me, I sometimes miss the boat when it comes to newer technologies. So excuse the pun, Nick Dennis from Anchor Capital, but what do you see as the key differences between good and fad tech investing?
So, look, I think the key, Chantal, and thanks for having me on, is you aren't able to differentiate unless you gain an understanding at the product level, and so sometimes or often you're not going to be able to know the difference with really cutting edge tech. And so, like, I personally, for a lot of the newer stuff, I don't try to differentiate, but where you can understand the products, understand what sort of value it brings to the customer. Does it save the customer time or money, or does it sort of bring them new features or services that they didn't have before? Then I think you can differentiate. If you can't do that, then it's indistinguishable, and I would rather just stay away.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing. Sorry.
No. Go ahead.
The final point that I make is, you know, this doesn't matter when the market's going up, but it's when you find that your shares are down 20 or 30%, that's when it really matters. And, you know, with a fad, or if it's a piece of cutting edge tech that you don't understand properly, if it's down 30%, you're not going to know, should I hold on or should I add? And so that's why I think it's really important that you actually really have a deep understanding at the product level, what the company's doing.
Yeah, I guess I think for me, where I usually struggle is as I'm getting a little bit older, things like ByteDance's TikTok really doesn't make that much sense to me. But I can see that there's a user case, for example, for young people who really enjoy dancing into a camera and posting it online for the world to see. But I think what I'm getting to is perhaps when I don't really understand it, someone else will. And my next question kind of speaks to that. Does it make sense to wait for tech shares to list and then kind of buy them in the market, or to actually look towards early stage investors and guys with a really deep understanding of the sector, like a SoftBank or even a Naspers, if you ignore Tencent or Tencent for that matter?
Yeah, so I think the point that you raise on TikTok is an interesting one, and I've certainly been guilty of what you mentioned in the past in dismissing something that on the face of it seems silly, but quite often the really interesting things in the tech space start off as games, or they seem kind of silly, and then the really interesting use cases emerge later. So I sort of over time I've had to train myself to kind of not dismiss these things, and to take them a bit more seriously. And then, I agree to your second point. It's often those VC stage investors, like the Benchmarks or the A16Zs of the world, they're actually really good at, you know, to my previous point, is actually understanding the product. What is it trying to do? How is it different versus the alternatives? Whereas the sort of later stage investors in the public markets, like myself, we can tend to be kind of more conservative and more kind of driven by the metrics, which could actually be the wrong approach. Like if you get the product right, the metrics come later. And I think that's what your SoftBanks and your VC type investors often get right.
Yeah, I mean, as I said in my intro, I usually miss the boat at first because I want a company to be cash flow positive, and I want the balance sheet to look decent, and I want the revenue to start coming through quite strongly. So I absolutely agree. Perhaps the answer is that if you do tend to be a more conservative investor like I am, look towards less conservative investors, but where you are quite happy with their underlying metrics and the diversification of their portfolio. Anything you are particularly excited about right now, something new on the horizon that we might not know about, or anything that you're very cautious about currently?
Look, I tend to be more in the bullish camp. I'm an optimist. And I think I think a lot of the companies that we have today, like the next Tesla, for example, I think is going to be Tesla. And I think, you know, trends like e-commerce, I think it's still early days. So for a lot of these spaces and their business models are starting to deliver along, you know, in terms of, or some of them are in terms of cash flow and returns on invested capital, all of those kind of metrics. And so I think you actually don't need to be on the very cutting edge to generate really exciting returns. So there's a lot of the trends that are just right in front of us today, I think still have a long, long time to play out.
Yeah, I really like that. You don't have to be at the cutting edge to make decent returns. Thank you so much. That was Nick Dennis from Anchor Capital. And that is it for today. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and app at 6:30 a.m. And the podcast is available from just after 7 a.m. A big high five to the team, Eddie, Caldora, Nicole, to you for listening, and my guests for their contributions. My name is Chantal Marks. This is MoneyWeb Now. Tune back in Monday with your regular host, a hopefully very well-rested Simon Brown.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.